Hi. As the name of the podcast suggests, I connect a lot of topics together in the service of growing the practice of psychotherapy. As the number of episodes grows, it occurred to me that I could offer you a way to organize the episodes. So I've created playlists. Playlists are compilations of all the episodes on one topic. If you'd like to try this out, there is a link in the show notes to the playlist page, where you will find the categories, and then you click on the category you're interested in, and you'll see all the episodes on that topic. I hope you enjoy it. While you're there, you could sign up for the newsletter if you like. Those come out weekly and are a great way for us to stay in touch, and for you to keep up to date about the podcast and additional events. Hello, and thank you for joining the Connection Therapy Podcast. This is a podcast about the craft of psychotherapy, and we seek to support those who strive to improve their craft by sharing research about the science and stories about the art of psychology. Together, we will explore these findings so you can decide how you want to apply them to benefit your practice. Working with children in therapy is inspiring because you see how resilient the human spirit can be. Of course, there are many things that make it difficult work, but for me, it is an honor, and I feel lucky to be among the mental health therapists who support children. As you may not be aware, a lot of psychologists and other mental health therapists will only work with adults. And one of the reasons I hear for this is because children can be hard to understand. And as a result, it can be hard to know when therapy is working. Children have difficulty knowing and explaining their own feelings. That is a skill learned over time. And let's be honest, even as adults, it is still a challenge. In this work, it is hard to know with confidence what children mean when they say things. Depending on their age, they might be saying things they think they are supposed to say. By the time a child meets a mental health therapist like me, there have been many caregivers, teachers, coaches, and more who have tried to help them in some way. Most well-meaning people give advice to kids or tell them how to think and what to feel. It is a natural response, especially when a child is suffering. So a lot of times when I first meet a child, they repeat back to me all the things they have heard other adults say to them about the situation. So as therapists who work with children, we have to have additional ways to observe treatment progress in the areas that need support. The major treatment goals are worked out and addressed in discussion with caregivers, but session to session, how do we know if what we are doing in therapy is in service to the overall therapy goals? This is especially difficult for people who are just learning to do play therapy because it is confusing how playing a game can be therapeutic. Anna Freud explained that the therapist must be, quote, familiar with the normal sequence of child development, end quote, for successful treatment. Children often do not have the capacities to accurately self-report treatment progress. And an important historical note here is that much of Anna Freud's work with children was done during wartime. So there was no opportunity to check in really with the caregivers about progress. And the overarching trauma of being at war affected everyone, even the therapists, of course. So Anna Freud and others suggested observing where children are in their development and formulating treatment goals to support them in being on task with their peers of a similar age. I have always liked this approach. It's just so straightforward. I support children and families who have experienced trauma, among other concerns. And so the idea that we can get beyond verbal reports of treatment success for kids works for me. Because trauma can be so integral to a person that it affects their developmental progression. To say that in a more straightforward way, trauma stunts or slows down child development. So Anna Freud's idea of essentially evaluating whether or not the child is displaying and doing behaviors appropriate for their age is a really common sense method of assessment. And it levels things out from the perspective of what the root causes of the suffering are. As a therapist, you just know you want to help them achieve developmental milestones from a psychological perspective, and that's your main goal. And when you see them doing that, that's how you know you are meeting the goal, which is really helpful. So, as mental health therapists, we need to understand a lot about child development so that we can make educated assessments on how to help, and we can have some level of confidence that when a child starts to do the things that are typical for their age, as in they catch up to the milestones, that is the best indicator of treatment progress. In this episode, I'm going to share more about a developmental model that I use to help frame what I am hearing and seeing in session to understand the child better. I shared in episodes 5 and 6 some of how this works with adults. And in this episode and some of the following ones, I'm going to make good on my earlier promise to explain how I use Eric Erickson's 8-stage model of development when working with children. When I was first starting to study psychology, it was challenging for me when people used terms like developmental model, because I didn't know what that meant, and I was worried that if I didn't understand the actual terms, then I would not get the overall concept. So in case you are just starting to learn these concepts and have a similar feeling to what I did, let me explain. A developmental model is a way to organize human growth. There is a general way that most humans grow from being an infant to an elder adult. And while things do differ across the world with unique cultures and even historical time periods, it is uncanny how there are similar things at similar ages. A lot of times we might think of these in terms of physical ability milestones. As an example, there are average ranges, but most children begin walking and talking within a few months of each other. These are physical growth expectations, and there are also psychological growth expectations too. Psychological growth expectations, as you might imagine, are not as clearly defined as the physical ones. It is harder to see how someone is feeling or thinking than it is to see if they are walking yet. This complexity, along with the fact that there are many theories as to how and why we develop in the ways we do as we mature, are in part why there are many models for how we develop psychologically. So, in addition to what children say as mental health therapists, we want to start identifying where, on average, we expect their psychological maturity to be. And if we see delays, then we can develop treatment plans that help them obtain these skills. I'm trained from a variety of perspectives in psychology, and I have been introduced to a variety of developmental models. But the one that makes the most sense to me, and the one I can remember the easiest, is Erickson's 8-stage one. I'm going to provide an overview of each of the stages for child development in this episode, and then in future episodes, I will illustrate how the model works in therapy sessions for each stage. But first, a reminder on the history. Eric Erickson developed an 8-stage model for human development. He was originally a student of Sigmund Freud and Sigmund's daughter Anna Freud, but there was a falling out, in part because Erickson's own theories went in new directions, in that he included more elements of culture and other factors that influence us from the outside, which was more than the original internal drives that the Freuds hypothesized. In the book Freud and Beyond, A History of Modern Psychoanalytic Theory by Mitchell and Black, they discuss Erickson's view of the development of the ego as a continual process of the tension between the innate qualities of our physical being, called the drives, and our socialization into the world and culture. So it's sort of this tension between what's happening for us internally, like what's developing, and what's happening for us externally, like the pressures on us from outside. This is another reason why I like this model, because Erickson went further than the original discussion of psychoanalytic theory, and he included environmental stressors and personal history as part of the forces the individual has to navigate to arrive at the next level of development. As a therapist now, you are invited to consider a wide variety of factors that are influencing your patient. And the more we learn about trauma and how it stunts growth, the more this has been helpful for me to conceptualize what is happening for someone. The model is structured on how one resolves the conflicts the instinctual drives present while moderating the environmental stressors during each phase of development. So the idea is that we don't achieve a certain skill as humans and then never face that conflict again. Instead, we continually face dilemmas throughout the lifespan, but what tends to happen is we progress our capacity to meet each challenge by building on things we learned from the earlier stages. Okay, so let's consider the stages. Over the years, the age ranges have shifted slightly, so this is in general how they break down. For stage one, we're looking at infancy to 18 months. And the conflict to be resolved is trust versus mistrust. Stage two, 18 months to about 2 years. And the conflict is between autonomy versus shame. Stage three runs from age 3 to 5. And the conflict is between initiative versus guilt. Stage four is from 6 years to about 11 years old. And we are resolving the conflict between industry versus inferiority. And stage five is from 12 to 18 years old. And the conflict is identity versus role confusion. As a reminder, in episode 6, I reviewed the stages 6, 7, and 8, which are for adults. So we're going to stop here with stage 5 because these are the ones for children. So that's an overview of the name. So now let's just talk about what happens in each of them briefly. And then, as I mentioned, I'll break them into separate episodes and talk about how you can see them in session when you're working with children. So for stage 1, trust versus mistrust. This is an interesting concept because what it reminds us of is how vulnerable humans, all of us are or were at some point at this stage. We are completely dependent on others. And so the way I conceptualize at this stage is that either the environment and the caregivers who are taking care of you when you are an infant are going to be consistent and predictable in such a way that you can develop trust in routines, trust in someone approaching you in a similar way each day, trust in if someone asks you to do something that there's a purpose to it. All of these kind of consistent and predictable routines are how I conceptualize that people learn this part of the stage of development that Erickson's defining. We are so vulnerable as humans at this stage that we are completely dependent on the environment around us. And as we exit this stage, we either have a fundamental trust in the world around us, you know, that things kind of go in a similar way and that things are mostly okay, or we have a mistrust at this stage that there aren't any predictable patterns. You know, sometimes things happen in a way that they don't happen another time. It's a difficult stage to understand because it's so nebulous, and it's also difficult to work with therapeutically. So I'll say more about it in a future episode, but just a spoiler alert here. Typically, if you are going to help families with children of this age, you're working in a family unit, or at least with one or more of the caregivers, because since the child is so dependent on the environment, then therapeutic interventions here are more global in nature, not toward the individual child yet. Stage two, autonomy versus shame. This is where Erickson's ideas of the drives and moderation come into play. So the age range here is 18 months to 2 years. And what happens here is At this age, humans develop the ability to become independently mobile. And what I mean by that is they can walk and they can walk away from their family of origin into kind of dangerous areas sometimes. You know, if you can think about it, when humans were sort of walking the earth and there wasn't a civilization, then of course it's walking through the forest or something like that. But even in today's world, you know, going to an airport or a public place, children at this stage have the ability to move away from their caregivers. So that's the autonomy part. And yet they hopefully have built on the previous stage and have a trust that their caregivers mean well. So when they ask them to come back or stay close, that there's a purpose for that. Also in this stage, we're seeing kids do toilet training. And so that's kind of where the shame part comes from, is there is, you know, this is coming right off of Freud's initial theories about this stage where it can result in shame. But one of the most helpful things that I have heard from a therapy perspective is the idea of shame versus guilt, which guilt we'll see in the next stage, is that shame is the idea that someone feels, I am bad. Like as a young child, or even sometimes as an adult, you meet someone and the way they phrase things is that they are a bad person. The thinking here is that a lot of that framing of how one sees oneself comes from this stage. And so when I'm working, I try to always listen for the kind of wording that is used in stage two, because these are young children, so you can't really have full sentence discussions. What tends to happen is that things are either good or bad, black or white. You like them, you don't like them. You know, food tastes good, tastes bad. And so the child is trying to navigate this newfound autonomy along with the feelings of shame when they kind of don't rise to the standard of their environment, or they make some mistakes, or what they perceive to be something bad. We'll say a lot more about that in the future episodes, but for now, let's look at stage three, which goes from 3 years to 5 years, where the conflict is between initiative and guilt. Initiative, to me, in Erikson's terminology, has a lot to do with the fact that now kids are starting to understand that they can do things in the world. They can really influence things in the world. And they're trying to get some confidence in that. And a lot of times they take on responsibilities that are bigger than their, you know, their bodies and their development enables them to do, because they're trying to understand like this idea of action and reaction. And guilt now is considered not that they are bad like it was in the previous stage, it's that I did something bad. And it's really important from a therapy perspective to consider that subtle change in language represents a massive change in internal psychological thinking about oneself. Because in stage two, the previous stage, if one feels that they are a bad person, there's really nowhere to go with that, right? Like the whole experience is, I am bad. There's nothing that distinguishes me from that quality. But now in stage three, they're starting to develop the realization that they are separate from others and other people in the world and other things. And sometimes they make mistakes and they do a bad thing, but maybe not necessarily are they a bad kid. And that's a really important psychological move that will set them up for a lot of good outcomes in the future if this distinguishing feature of the development stage here can be, you know, really locked in. And on occasion, I meet adults who still are considering themselves as maybe this original framing from the previous stage. And this is actually where, no matter what age, if this part of this stage isn't fully developed in someone, then we really try to help them delineate the characteristic of being bad or good. And maybe there's a lot more things to that which come later as we mature, but trying to get out of that black and white thinking from the previous stage is an important psychological move in this stage and some for the ones beyond. So then we come to stage 4, industry versus inferiority, age 6 to 11. Again, we're talking about this idea of industry, which is kind of an interesting word that Erikson selected for this stage. To me, it's still about this idea of being competent, wanting to participate in their family of origin. You know, this is where kids start to get maybe some chores around the house or have some responsibilities appropriate to their age. And this is where that kind of real pride can come in doing those chores or in getting good grades. There's ways that this industry can starts to be associated with their personal character. And then sadly, this is also that time of life where we enter middle school. And I think most people I've ever met, if they would like to return to any age in their life, it's never going back to the ages they experienced during middle school, because it's a really tough stage. So this is where what also tends to happen is, you know, you can feel kind of really proud and yet also inferior, because now you're into, for most children, you're into a school environment where you realize other kids are different and they have different abilities and they are, have different families. And there's all kinds of ways that this sort of measuring gets into the human experience. It's really normal phase. I don't mean to discount it. It's part of our development. We have to understand things about other humans, and this is one way at this age that we do that. This is also a time, and again, we'll talk more about this in a future episode, where narcissism is healthy. Wait, what? Did I really just say that? Yes, I did. It's important here that kids get the ability to feel like the world is really focused on them and their accomplishments. And so you see some need, and many developmental theories will include the need for a healthy dose of narcissism. And it starts to come on in this fourth stage, industry versus inferiority. Then we have the fifth stage, age 12 to 18 years. Of course, this stage, the transition here, typically corresponds with the onset of puberty, and the conflict is identity versus role confusion. So in this stage, we're starting to see children develop, you know, like who they are. And of course, many of those features will change as they develop. But this is where children get very interested in thinking about, you know, who they're going to be. You see a lot of discussions in schools at these ages of exploring different roles and jobs in the community, and children start to identify with maybe some different roles or jobs that they see others doing that they would like to do. And when I'm working with teenagers, I call this the trying on coats stage, because I feel like sometimes when I'm working with teenagers, almost every session, they're like trying on a different persona. And I call that like a different coat. It's like they kind of go see if this one fits or that one fits. They're really starting to consider their family of origin. And this is where kids often get really curious about their extended family, because they're trying to figure out who they're like, and by extension, you know, who they are and who they're going to become. And it's really healthy for that identity to shift until it starts to formulate for them and they feel a sense of identity at the end of this stage. While the resolution of this stage might be the formation of a personal identity, I think it is important to comment and remember here that this will later be modified. If you've matured past this stage, you know that it is normal for identity to continue to develop throughout one's lifetime. So that's an overview of the stages for children that Erik Erikson identified. And as I mentioned in future episodes, I look forward to discussing those in more detail with you and sharing how you can see them show up in your cases in session, and I'll share some ways to help identify and assist development in different areas within each stage. Thanks. I hope you'll join us again for future explorations in the field of psychology. And if you'd like to take a step further, there are additional ways to obtain more education and support on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. While there, you will find information about the authors and studies featured in the podcast episodes. Also, you will see a schedule of live trainings I offer on the topics featured in the podcast. And you will find information about the Connection Community, a growing group of mental health clinicians dedicated to the study and practice of psychotherapy. Please check out our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com, to learn more. Thanks. Until next time.